Hello, my name is Chip Ling, and you are listening to Total EM. I have a special surprise this week. This week is a little different than usual because it is not actually me specifically for my podcast. I went on to Corner Talk, which is a podcast about death investigation, and I did this with Darren Dake. Darren and I are actually from the same area, and so I got to do my first reel in person recording, which is really, really nice. And he's got a great setup. So we recorded with him for his podcast to talk about some things about, you know, basically how we handle evidence, how we could handle evidence better, how we work with the death investigation team, stuff like that. So this is something that will be a little different than it usually is for us, but I think it's one worth still listening to, one still worth kind of going over. And I definitely would love your feedback and what you guys do at different locations. Also, please check out Coroner Talk, because even though we don't do death investigation per se, we are involved in the process. So it's worth us getting involved to better understand what we are talking about and how we can better help our colleagues, especially in the investigation process and making sure we don't screw anything up for them. All right, so let's go ahead and get started on this.
All right, I'm back. And as I introduced earlier, I've got Chip Ling in the studio with me. It's a rare occasion that I have somebody actually in the Coroner Talk studios. Normally, I'm bringing somebody in through Skype or something like that. But I actually have someone in the studios today. Chip, welcome to the Coroner Talk studios.
Thank you. I'm glad to do this. This is actually the first one I've got to do in person for a really long time.
Well, and it's interesting that you're a podcaster as well. And that's the reason that I brought you on is because, one, the podcast topic that you have is very interesting to my group, and I want to kind of share. I think we may share audiences with this show, but you have a podcast called Total EM. Now, is that how you say the Total EM, or is there something more to that?
Yeah, so it's Total EM, but it's an acronym. So it stands for Tools of the Trade in Academic Learning and Emergency Medicine, which is a mouthful, so that's why you just use Total EM. That's where we exist. We exist on totalem.org, and we've got podcasts out. We're getting close to 100 right now, actually.
Very nice. Now, you do a podcast once a week?
Yes.
That's great. So Total EM is emergency medicine, right? But tell me what you do. What is your field of expertise and things like that?
Yeah, so I'm an emergency medicine PA, which is a physician assistant. And what I do is basically I see, diagnose, treat patients all the same like you expect from the physicians, or you'll even see the nurse practitioners. We all work in the same sort of aspect there. But what's unique, and the part of the reason why I have my podcast, because there are other emergency medicine podcasts out there, is because I focus on a lot of the rural and remote side. And I'm really the only, at least I was the first, practicing emergency medicine PA that was doing podcasting. So I bring in two elements. I bring in how to use EMPAs and how we do things and our training and our background, while still talking about a lot of the things that make emergency medicine unique from the big academic tertiary centers.
Well, one thing I've noticed about your podcast, and I listen to gobs of them, and I try to listen to EMS podcasts and fire and paramedic podcasts and things like that. Some are very well produced. Some are not very well produced. But I like yours because, number one, it has a high production quality. But the guests and the information that you bring forth is fantastic. Now, I will admit, there are topics that you talk about on there that ain't for me. You talk about some very medical specific things, which, of course, that's who you're talking to. That's your audience. And so some of the stuff I understand. I like the one the other day. The lady talked about the air ambulances and the crashing of those and some restructuring. That I understood. However, the thing that interests me is that you're fulfilling a need and a niche through podcasting like I am that isn't necessarily fulfilled anywhere else.
Right. And to me, that was the biggest thing is there was a need for those areas. There really wasn't something for emergency medicine PAs. There really wasn't something for rural and remote medicine. Some of the favorite podcasts I listen to, they sound amazing. And they talk so much about emergency medicine, but they talk about specialists that don't even exist 100 miles anywhere around us. And that's a big deal when I have patients to deal with. But I really appreciate your comment. Thank you about the high production quality. I've really worked hard on it. If you go back to some of the original episodes, I apologize because I was just starting out and figuring that out. But I've gone through some courses and just figuring out things the hard way, like you probably have along the way, just trying to figure stuff out. But no, I enjoy it, and I'm glad to do something like this. And I'm really, really interested to talk to a totally different audience. Although, like you said, we probably have more people in similar than we would actually think. But this is something that I think we can help each other out on.
Right. And I agree that when you first started in podcasting, it gets pretty bad. I go back to my 4 years ago, so my first one was horrible. But let's kind of stop reminiscing here. Let's move on to our topic. Now, one of the things that you had that I've seen from your website is something called, if I'm pronouncing it right, foamed or foam-ed?
Correct, foam-ed.
So explain that to our listeners, what that means. Now, your listeners may know. Mine, however, probably does not.
So foam-ed stands for free and open access to medical education. And unlike a lot of things that are out there, you probably have seen this because you get something in the mail or because you hear about it, but you want to go to a course, you're going to pay thousands of dollars for that course. And a lot of that stuff is things that you would get through other resources. And in medicine, it's the same way. I mean, I am literally international. I got people, in fact, I just had someone the other day like me from Ukraine and start following me from there. I've got someone who just followed me from Vietnam today. So, I mean, all over the world, these are people who are not going to be able to attend these conferences. Then you've got the guy who's working in rural Minnesota who it's going to take him a long time to go anywhere or it's going to cost him a lot of money. So one of the beautiful things about FOMED is we can literally go all over the world for free. Information's out there for free. There's nothing you have to pay. Everything's there for you. And it's just something you can take up. So if you look up something by FOMED, you can usually find something. That's FOAMED.
Right. And I did look that up, and it was very interesting to read. There's a lot of other topics or podcast or journals, things that's around that whole FOMED thing. And what you said is about this free training. That's why the Corner Talk podcast originated back in 2014. That's why we're still doing it today. This is free education to coroners in rural areas and medical examiner investigators in rural areas to get some type of training every single week, similar to what you're doing. There's areas that they can't afford to go to training. They don't have access to training. And we do provide online training. We're doing a lot of other stuff we can do. But the podcast provides something of training every single week in some area. And you're fulfilling the same thing in the emergency medicine side, which is very interesting. Now, we are our two groups of audiences does mesh in one way in the real life. So here's what we want to get into today. You will first see a patient that I jokingly say, because I know we're sharing audiences here, so I hope your audience don't send me hate mail. When you guys fail, we have to come in. Okay. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And I know you don't fail. Some people are going to die regardless of what you do. But when they die, then we as medical examiner investigators, coroners, police officers, we have to step in then and investigate. So what you do really affects how our investigation can go sometimes. Sometimes not only at the present time, but even throughout the court case and things like that. I know you've been experienced in times where someone has died in the ER. And you primarily do ER, correct?
Correct.
So someone has died in the ER that then here comes the police right in behind them because of that death.
Right. So a lot of times, and I guess I should just mention as kind of a quick disclaimer here, the scenarios and the cases we're going to talk about are all HIPAA compliant because basically I changed so many details. It's basically its own unique case that we just basically make up. But an example would be maybe someone who comes in with multiple gunshot wounds. I know that police are going to be coming because A, we're going to have to report it if they didn't already know, but most likely B, someone has called 911 already and we're expecting them coming. So we're going to try our best to resuscitate them. But so one of the things we're talking about, Darren, is that sometimes things that I'm going to have to do is going to in some ways possibly disrupt the evidence or what's going to help down the line for the investigation of this person's death. And I think that's the thing that becomes always the trickiest part is part of me and most of me is focusing on doing the resuscitation, trying my best to get that patient back. But a little part of me has to remember to try my best not to do something that's going to cause problems down the line when it comes to the actual death investigation.
Right. And that's something that emergency medicine across the board needs to understand from paramedics on. Now, even in big cities, okay, even in big city hospitals, yes, that's important. But sometimes in big city hospitals, they spend more time training about that type of things. In rural areas, sometimes there's not that much training. Sometimes, even in rural areas, you've got nurses and PAs. Well, I'm speaking for PAs, maybe not. But I know nurses a lot of times in rural areas will work in two or three different hospitals on a rotation basis. Well, what's good in rules in one hospital may not be the same for another. And do you find that in rural areas to be a problem sometimes when it comes to consistency and like evidence control?
Right. In fact, a lot of people, whether PAs, NPs, physicians, or like you said, nurses, we tend to work in multiple places, maybe not always at the same time, but we have experience of working all these different places because usually there's a shortage everywhere and they need all of us. And so we tend to bounce from one place to the next and so on and so forth. It's not uncommon that most of us are working probably 2 to 3 hospitals easy, if not more. But the question becomes is, okay, what's the policy or procedure here? How does law enforcement like something done at this particular location versus another city? Or do they even really get involved? One thing, and I know it's slightly different, but it's in the same kind of category as our state exams. So with these specialized nurses who are specifically trained for sexual assaults, that's a lot of specialized training. And some hospitals just don't have it at all, or they have very minimal training. So it's a much bigger deal. But even when it comes to the emergency medicine side, like dealing with these resuscitations and stuff where they don't go the way we want them to ultimately, again, it's tricky. How do you do this safely, and how do you do it in a way that's going to help out everyone involved?
Well, one of the things you guys may have is somebody come in presenting with a bump on the head, but what actually has been is a bar fight and someone got hit in the head with a ball bat that's going to end up being a police investigation where someone dies or not. A lot of times what comes into ERs, at least from my experience, you don't always know the backstory. You just know that you have a patient presenting with something that the paramedics told you, and they may or may not even relate to you that was from a bar fight.
One of my favorite little phrases is sock mob. So standing on the corner, minding my own business. That's the most common cause of why someone got the crap beat out of them is because they were, you know, sock mob. They were just minding their own business, and someone just all of a sudden hit them with a baseball bat or, you know, chased them down and beat them up. There's usually a story there, but for one reason or another, they're not reporting it to us. And so, yeah, a lot of times we have to deal with that. I had a patient who actually got in a bar fight, and they were young enough, they were worried because there was underage drinking involved and everything else, that they didn't want to admit that this is what it was. And downstream caused some major issues for them because they developed an infection that, having known that it was from a bite versus a knife wound, which he said he accidentally stabbed himself, would be a totally different story. And how we'd treat that would be different. So again, it's not an immediate life threat. Like you said, it's not always someone dies that we get involved with these investigations, but sometimes having those little details, having those little differences in the information can make a huge difference down line as far as how we take care of things.
Right. And one of the things I wanted to point out here, again, we're talking a lot about rural, but when you're in a rural area, sometimes you have patients come in that you have to fly out.
Correct.
There's a lot of rural areas that will stabilize a patient and fly out. And in the police investigation, in the coroner industry, we like that first draw blood. Is that something that the hospitals that you've worked at or the training that you do around the country, is that something that you promote, or is that something that just it's done, if not, it's not?
So a lot of times patients are usually going to be in a setting where someone can draw blood pretty quickly. Now, given there are some limitations to that, and there have only probably been a handful of times where I said, really, this patient is so unstable, I don't have time to try and worry about blood work because that's going to have someone come in that's going to get in everyone else's way who's actively trying to resuscitate the patient. Usually that's not going to happen though, because especially in most of the places I work at now, our nurses are so good, so quick that they will usually get blood while they're getting the IV. But if for some reason they're having a hard stick or they're not having the easiest time with that, we may not be able to get that. But most of the time, and usually what I'm going to try and do is to get the blood work early, like you said. And does it usually change my management? Most of the time, not if they're really sick, because even if their, for example, hemoglobin is 12, but there's half their blood volume is on the floor, that hemoglobin is not going to be right. They're most likely down to a hemoglobin of 5 or 6. And that may not necessarily mean something specifically to your audience, but for my audience, they understand that, hey, this is an issue. This person's bleeding out. They just haven't done the physiologic changes yet to make that happen where that number drops down. So I may not necessarily pay attention to the number, but sometimes it's helpful when you get the MVC patient, for example, who was involved in a bad car accident and they're bleeding out everywhere. And now the blood alcohol comes back later on that they were, you know, 0.4, for example. They had a nice high blood alcohol, or 400, depending on how you translate it or whatever. But, you know, they have a high blood alcohol volume or blood alcohol concentration. So those types of things, you know, can help us down the line. But a lot of times we're not going to get that back right away, but maybe something that would still be beneficial to you guys later.
Right. And that's what I was getting at is when you've got a patient coming in that you're having to work on, you know, that's critical, certainly the blood, you're going to draw it, but that isn't the most important right now. But what it becomes important is if you're stabilizing somebody to fly them out and they get to a big city trauma center or something and die, maybe it's within hours, but maybe it's within 2 or 3 days. We've had cases, of course, we all have, where somebody's been put on a ventilator in a big city trauma center. They eventually become brain dead. We have MTS here, I'm sorry, but whatever OPO you have in your area steps in and the patient's then declared dead and it moves forward from there. We get notified that the person has died from an accident or a fall down the steps or something for 4 or 5 days ago. Well, there is no blood that we can get from anywhere that's going to give us any information if the first hospital didn't draw blood. Now, sometimes it's not possible, but if you're going to get somebody in and package them up to fly them out, if the emergency rooms could draw blood, and a lot of times the hospitals will keep them for a certain amount of time, that helps us so much because we have certain guidelines that we have to do to the state. But also, when we investigate it, it helps us to know if this person was intoxicated or had drugs on board, something like that, where multiple days later, we won't have any of that. Even if the receiving hospital does draw blood and do toxicology, if you've ran a couple of bags of fluid through them, you know, and they're bleeding internally, I don't have a good result because you guys have diluted it so bad trying to save this person's life. So first blood is important. And I think that's something if I wanted to get out to your listeners, you know, if you ever had the choice, get some first blood to store in that lab if this patient is extremely critical.
Yeah. And like I said, usually we're pretty good about that. The other thing that I would chime in and add with that as well, Darren, is that, when you're doing that, usually a lot of times these patients are critical enough, they're getting a Foley catheter. So they're getting an indwelling urinary catheter that is going to stay there for the probably for the duration of their critical illness, or at least for a certain amount of time afterwards. So we usually get urine as well. And this is very helpful for you guys too, because of the urine drug screen part. Because a lot of times, most of these rural hospitals will have very limited serum drug screens. So a lot of times it may be just alcohol, aspirin, and Tylenol levels or acetaminophen levels. But that's about it. So most of the time, we're going to get our other things, our cannabinoids, our opiates, our benzos, all those types of drug markers that can be helpful to us. Now, given there's obviously limitations, like if it's synthetics or stuff like that, they won't always come up. But we try and do that as well. We try and get that quickly. And usually that gets sent off because, like you said, it may not make a huge difference on our end right now, but later on can be very important for you guys.
Right. And I guess when you're critical and you're stabilizing them to fly out, you may not have the full time to get a full blood workup. But if you know somebody is not only they critical from an assault, but also they have a high level of opioids in their system, that can also change your treatment.
Yes.
If you start pushing a lot more opioids, you're actually causing more of a problem. You need to get rid of some of that. And if you don't know it, of course, I guess some of that's tested pretty quickly. But those are the type of things, of course, investigators need to know.
And we try and use, at least I do, some people may not follow this as much, but it'd be a recommendation I have, at least with this type of issue, is I tend to use medications for sedation. Say if they're maybe they're not deceased, but they are critically ill and they are going to need some workup. Rather than give them more opiates, like you said, I will try and use other medications that most likely is not what this patient took. So for example, if I need to intubate and sedate them, I will use ketamine. Because most of the time, ketamine is not being used recreationally, or at least not in the purpose that most of the time we're pretty safe there. So when their opiate levels are high of whatever type or whatever, you can use that later. And of course, we try and document very well that what we gave and how we gave it. So that way, if a tox screen, a more detailed tox screen is done later, that will hopefully answer some of those questions as far as what we gave versus what they probably had in their system ahead of time.
Right. And that those type of things, also things we need to know, because if they do die and we send their autopsy, those types of toxicology things, we'll want to know those as well for toxicology. But let's switch gears just here a little bit. We still have the same patient coming in, and we have, let's say we have a stabbing or a gunshot or any type of assault, but certainly get stabbing and gunshots where we have holes in the clothing. You know, we like to tell your emergency room staff not to be cutting through those holes. Cut around those holes. I know we cut clothes off quick, You know, if you can cut on a seam, I teach our investigators when they're taking clothes off a decedent, just cut up a seam. As long as there's no holes in that seam, whatever, you're pretty well then can lay the shirt or the pants back on. Is that taught to emergency staff, or is that something that's hit and miss, not really talked about?
So I started out in EMS, and when I was in EMS and how our training was there, it was actually very much, there was a very good piece of information about that. And that was actually one of the things that I feel like I use the most still when it comes to this type of situation, is to make sure that we're avoiding any cuts or any sort of, I'd say, clothing breakdown in general, because if it was an MVC and they're skidding across the ground, they may have had ripped off part of their jeans or whatever else. We'll try and cut around those areas versus cutting through them, like you said. But most of the time, it's not always taught to, say, your medical school's PA programs, stuff like that, where they may not always be teaching. I don't remember that specifically in my PA training. I'm pretty sure they did, because we had it like a little bit of a death investigation training and stuff like that. But I remember it more from my EMS training, because how important it was and how much it was harped on that when we do take clothing off, like you said, cut at the seams or cut around areas mainly where there are any sort of breakdown in the actual clothing itself, whether that's a hole from a penetrating wound or if it's an abrasion type where part of the jeans or whatever is ripped off with it, all those types of things, cut around them versus cutting through them.
Right. And I know that it's easy for me or another investigator to talk to a doctor, PA, nurse, emergency staff whatsoever, and paramedics even, and say, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. Well, yes, that's easy for us to say. But then when you're there, your whole goal is to save this person's life. Yes, you need to think about these things. But quite honestly, you don't have time to think about the whether I need that hole protected. You've got to get to the hole in the body and get it fixed, right? I get that. Even paramedics on the scene, sometimes there's a headbutting goes on there because paramedics go on a scene, and paramedics can say, I want paramedics to save every single life they can save. But paramedics as a whole destroys a scene. The only people that destroy a scene worse is the fire department, and that's not even their fault either, because they got a fire going on. The point is, paramedics can't always help it. They're there to save life. They go in, they're saving lives. They're not really worried about the evidence side of it. Now, we try to teach them how to look at evidence, how not to take evidence out with them. You know, we try to teach that kind of stuff. But I do understand it's not their primary role. And so I give them that. But these types of conversations help, Chip. I think that when someone comes in, you'll have paramedics listening to this show. Your audience has paramedics and PAs and ER doctors. Maybe this will spark something like, oh, wait a minute, we got a gunshot victim. You know what? Let's not cut through those holes, guys. Let's make sure we do this. Let's make sure we do that. And not they would purposely do it. It's that they would now think about how they can help prevent some things. Because again, I think this is what I tell my paramedics. Total patient care is total patient care. So you're going to save their life. You may and you may not, depending on the level of injury. But total patient care, then, if you don't save their life because their injuries are so bad, then it comes to me and the police officers to decide if this was self-inflicted, an accident, or a homicide. And if it's a homicide, someone needs to be held accountable. So as a paramedic, as a PA, an ER doctor, total patient care goes beyond death. Now, again, I give the fact that that's not your primary importance, but I think it needs to be remembered in these cases.
Absolutely. And having both the EMS and firefighting side, I can totally agree. We destroy things, and sometimes we have some fun of it. Obviously, not when it's in regards to an investigation, but firefighters have a reputation of, well, tearing up a place even when it didn't have to be torn up. But with all that said in mind, I absolutely agree. And I think one thing is just the simple stuff that we can do. Let's go back to a gunshot wound. Let's say it was in the leg, because that's an easy spot. You know, someone was shot in the leg. One issue I see is that sometimes we'll, you know, whoever is cutting off the clothes, whether it's nurse, paramedic, us as the PA, physician, whatever, usually we're not, because we're standing more hands off trying to do our other procedures, but someone's ripping off clothes. And sometimes they are literally ripping off clothes. What happens is they start with trauma shears. They may do cut, start to break through the fabric. And then what they'll do is they'll take their hands and they'll rip it down and rip it apart. And that may be okay on a side that does not have any of those breakdown in the clothing, like we've talked about, whether it's a gunshot wound or whatever else. But if you do that on the side where it does have that, and I've seen this happen before so many times, sadly, is that they get in a hurry. They just want to rip clothes off. So they end up ripping through that hole. They didn't mean to do it, but that's probably the most common way I see that happen. So what I would encourage audience listening is if you are going to do this, if you say, hey, I just need to rip off clothes, that's fine, but really try to avoid it on the areas of injury. If you can cut, literally take those trauma shears and cut down versus using just your hands and brute strength to rip things apart, I think you'll find that you will do a better job preserving evidence. And that's probably one of the easiest things you can do. You can literally do that in your next shift, and that will not cause any problems down the line. And it's going to be, what, a couple of seconds difference, and that's it? Why not try and save the evidence?
Yeah, and a lot of this stuff, slowing down on this, isn't going to put the patient in jeopardy.
Right, right.
You're only talking about a second or two just to do something right. And so, but then along the same lines as clothing, here's some things that... That we want emergency personnel to think about. Let's say we're going back to a gunshot. You don't know at this point if it's self-inflicted. You don't have any idea. Even if the paramedics told you it was self-inflicted, you don't know that for sure. But so whenever you're taking clothing off, again, I'm not asking you to do anything at that point other than just think about this. If you take off shoes and socks, it would be fantastic if you could put the left shoe with the left sock and the right shoe with the right sock. Now you say, why? I mean, we ain't got time for that. I get it. But here's why. Maybe that can tell us a lot about what happened in that scene. You know, you may have blood on one. There may be there's so many scenarios it could be. There somebody might have kicked somebody, or we may have blood transfer, something like that, where that means something. But if you can't do anything else, then it all goes in the same bag. But if I had a perfect world would be shirt and pants and socks all go, and the shoes go in separate bags. That's a perfect world. But ultimately, and here's something that's happened in the past that I think that we need to bring out. A lot of hospitals will use, they'll just throw everything into a pillowcase. And I think we talked about this the other day. Well, that's fine. Pillowcases are easy. Paramedics have them. Ambulance have them. We get hit our mind all the time. Don't put stuff in plastic. Don't put stuff in plastic, especially bloody.
Can we explain why not to use plastic real quick?
Yeah. So when you don't use it, if you use plastic, then, of course, over time, that's going to decompose and break down. The blood's going to break down and decompose and ruin whatever evidence you may have as far as DNA and things like that. Short term, not so bad, just, you know, for an hour or two. Long term, we say let it dry out and put it in paper. But because we said that, emergency room staff a lot of times have moved to pillowcases. They breathe. They put stuff in there. They can protect it. That's fine. But a case came up recently, been a couple of years ago, where a rape murder, the guy, the part of his defense was that hair, that pubic hair that was found in that pillowcase wasn't from him assaulting his ex-girlfriend. It was because he was in the hospital 3 weeks earlier, and apparently the laundry staff don't clean their stuff very good. Now, far stretch, but boy, I tell you, when it comes to attorneys, they really, really can take mountains out of molehills, and they stretch this thing. And well, there's no probable cause. There's probable cause. This guy was in the hospital. Obviously his hair could have been on the pillowcase. There's no way to know whether that pillowcase was his. So now we say, just throw it in a plastic bag. The police will be there in an hour. If not going to be there in an hour, then stick it in the morgue, at least cool it down, stick it in the morgue. The police will be there. And if you can separate it. And sane nurses will probably understand that part better than just regular nurses, non-sane nurses.
Yeah, and actually, most places that have a sane program, you know, they have something in place for a sane nurse to do their examination, will have the paper bags and everything like that. So sometimes we actually do, you know, use basically one of those types of kits to do that if we had the resources for it. So we'll use the paper bags instead. That'd be optimal, right, for you
right.
guys?
Yeah.
So if we don't have that, and we have definitely done what you've talked about, we put them in, usually we have little patient care bags because someone's getting admitted or, you know, for our psych patients or whatever else. We usually have the plastic bags you're talking about. And like you said, they're not going to stay there very long. Once whoever's going to come to investigate this death, they usually are going to bring their things, just like sometimes with SANE programs, they may actually have law enforcement bring in the big packet of what all they need. So usually someone's going to have the paper bags. It just is worth noting as early as possible. I like what you said about breaking up the clothes. Realistically, without the appropriate training, which hopefully this will at least allow some of that training to happen in a way that is very informal and can be very helpful, is that just try, like you said, Darren, just try to make sure that when you are taking off these clothes, you try and remove it and put it in separate bags, like you said. Sometimes that's really hard to do. I admit that, and I sometimes am responsible for the same thing. Sometimes too, and I think this is going to play a role for your investigation later on, is we don't always necessarily completely take off the clothes, especially very acutely. We may just cut off the top of the clothes so we can get access to the body, but not necessarily take the clothes out from underneath them. And I imagine that can cause some major issues for you if that person's still bleeding, that now you have more blood in certain spots that wasn't there with your initial injury. Or, you know, when I go in to put a chest tube, if there's still some clothing around there, then now I'm going to have a lot more blood because maybe they had blood in their lungs. And so when I do that, When I get blood out of the chest cavity, next thing you know, what was a very small wound without much bleeding to it now looks like, you know, is bleeding profusely the whole time. So I think it's something else worth mentioning. If you have the time, you have the ability to get the clothes out from them before you start doing any procedures with it. And if not, just try and at least explain that to whoever's going to be investigating.
No, you're exactly right. But I know that having more patient blood on the clothing isn't as big of a deal as if we think we have suspect blood, of course, we would like to separate that. But having things separated as much as possible. Now, obviously, we have suspect blood on something and we get a whole lot more patient blood on it. It's going to mix and we'll probably never find suspect blood or DNA. But, you know, anything we can, and that's what this conversation is about, Chip. It's not that we can solve all the problems. And let me tell you what, let me be honest with you. If my wife come in to your ER and had been sexually assaulted and was on the verge of death, I would much rather you save her life than to preserve the evidence of the suspect. Now, I would rather have my wife without an arrest than be able to prosecute somebody for her murder. So the first thing I want you to do is save her life. First and foremost, save her life. But in the process of that, if we could set something aside that might, or do something different that might help to prosecute, then that's all the better. From a husband's standpoint, but then also from an investigator standpoint, do what you can. But I understand that person's life's the most important. Prosecution comes 100% after. But we can all do things to help and to think about things going forward. And not every, you know, some cases are coming in where the person is critical, and there's nothing to think about except stabilize. Then you might have time to think about something. But I do get that. But anything comes top of mind where we're talking about a patient that you've dealt with?
So yeah, there, you know, we see a lot of overdoses, and that's becoming a rather frequent problem for pretty much anyone across the country. We're seeing overdoses. And some of the times we are seeing patients where they have acutely overdosed and they still have some form of medication on them. Now, the most common thing is opiates. And there have been a few cases recently where we have had the patient where they weren't stripped down beforehand or whatever, and they still had their clothing on them. And as we're taking clothes off, we find that they do have still pills or something on them. And some of these have been fentanyl or carfentanil, but they can be any number of drugs. But one of the big things I have been trying to do is that when we get this, we make a note of where that came from, and then I hand it to someone specifically, and that person's kind of the designated person for the chain of evidence until it gets into law enforcement hands. And so the places that we have security, which is most places nowadays, if security's there, I try and give it to security because that's going to be their primary job anyway. And this is communicating with law enforcement and preserving evidence and stuff like that. But if we don't, I will try and give it to a tech or a nurse to be responsible for and keep track of. And you'll be sometimes surprised where you find this because of, again, kind of the history of the patient. One not too long ago was in a patient's sock where we found it. And it was a couple of pills that later tested positive for fentanyl and carfentanil. And so that was something that was important later on for the death investigation to help confirm that this was actually what the patient overdosed on, which is what we were suspecting at the time anyway. But that's something I think is worth keeping in mind is evidence is not just about the clothing. It's not just about what's directly on the body. It's sometimes what comes with it. And one of the big things I've been trying to watch for are the pills or the drug paraphernalia of whatever type, and trying to keep those preserved and making sure that we're giving it to one person to be kind of responsible with and hold on to, and keeping that separate and labeled where that came from on the body.
That's extremely important. And one thing I'll add to that, giving it to somebody to be responsible for, and not in your facility, but we're talking generically here because we're all over the world, doesn't mean that that tech goes and lays it on the ER desk and then I'll come back to it later.
Right.
That person has to be in total control of that. Now, maybe they can lock it in a place where they only have a key to, they could somehow secure it to where no one else can get to it, or, you know, if they share something. But just setting it down doesn't help a chain of custody. Now, in your case, if you're able, like you said, if you're able to give it to security, then if they're there and you're passing the stuff to security, then your notes can say you found it in the sock, you passed it to security, then security has to deal with it, right? But that's very important. Passing it along to somebody also means it has to be secured in such a way that they can testify in court that it never was out of their control. Doesn't mean they have to hold on to it in their hand, but it means they have to somehow just testify that I locked it into a drawer that only me and the charge nurse have, or something to where it's limited. Because if depending on the case, it's very likely a person could get called to court to testify with this evidence. Now, maybe not in the situation you just talked about, but let's say it was a sexual assault. Let's say there was something found on the victim that specifically related to a suspect. If for some reason that was contaminated or thought could be contaminated because it was left in the open, it's no longer good evidence.
Yeah. One of the things that I've done, because we don't immediately have access to lockers, maybe because it's during the middle of an acute resuscitation or however we do this, that I usually try and make sure that we are at least handing it off, like I said, to security or whoever, and they're going to stay there with it. And we usually put it on like a table or something in the room so that way we can keep handing more. And then once the resuscitation's over, assuming that this was someone who died, but again, you can do this any number of ways. If it was someone who's still living and then get transferred out, we then hand it to security who then hands it to law enforcement, however that goes. But we try and keep that person in the room the whole time and put all the evidence in one location, usually, like I said, a table or something like that, where they can keep eyes on it, like you said.
Right. And that's good evidence at that point. At that point, you haven't changed anything. Well, let's move into talking about information. Now, HIPAA is a good thing, sorta.
Sorta.
HIPAA might be okay that you don't get to tell people that I have some venereal disease or I have some other problem, right? That's fine. But HIPAA sometimes, no, let me rephrase that. HIPAA always gets in the way of criminal investigations. Now, you know, when it comes to death, HIPAA, the person's medical privacy extends 50 years, I believe it is, after death. But when it comes to death itself, the coroner and medical examiner investigator has the right to get all the medical information with that person. So they can request the records and they get it without subpoena. Police officers have to have subpoena. However, I still see my local area is fine. We deal really good in my local area, but I hear of other states and other areas where coroners and medical examiners have a real problem sometimes getting information from the ER in real time if the person dies, because somebody that seems to be either uninformed or just doesn't want to help just says, well, I can't give that to you. That's HIPAA. Because that violates the HIPAA. It doesn't violate HIPAA. I mean, can you speak into that of what experience you have?
Yeah, and I kind of almost had to preface, I'm not an expert in HIPAA because obviously HIPAA is so complex as it is. But like you said, we have a basic understanding of this in medicine. I mean, we understand how this works. And if not, it's pretty easy to find good resources for it. But for me, when I'm working with this, usually I'm talking to law enforcement because I'm trying to get information from them too, because I want to know, like what you said, what was going on in the scene? That's the great thing about EMS, fire, law enforcement. Those guys were at the scene. I was not. I've been in the ED all day. This is what I've been doing. So I haven't got to see this. Pictures are nice. Stuff like that helps. But I have to keep in mind, they have stuff that they have to do right away that could make a difference, that could lead to an arrest, that could lead to the information that they need to know right away. And I think that's the biggest thing we have to keep in mind is, yes, you may think that HIPAA says that you cannot share information, but when it's coming to criminal investigation real time, it very much matters that we get the appropriate information. Now, that doesn't mean you have to go back and give them all the details. Well, this patient was previously diagnosed with hepatitis, or they had chlamydia when they were 12 years old or something like that.
Right.
I mean, that's not the information.
It has nothing to do with the current investigation.
Right. As long as you're giving information that is directly related to what is going on right now, and is something that is what you believe is appropriate that may lead to an arrest or prosecution, or maybe something that is very time sensitive, you're protected in that role, especially the time sensitive part. In fact, there has been some recent stuff in social media and in the news in general about where there has sometimes been that butting of heads between law enforcement and the medical field. Because sometimes what we think is stuff that can't be shared can be. And then other times, unfortunately, law enforcement does the same thing. They overstep their bounds on what they think they can do because, like you said, maybe they need to be under arrest first, or maybe they had to have a warrant or something else in mind. But most of the time, most of your law enforcement is going to be working with you and is going to be someone that, again, if it's something that is pertinent that needs to be dealt with right now, you need to give that information. Just like you would if someone was suicidal, you'd want to make sure that you reached out to law enforcement to help you with securing a 96-hour hold or doing whatever you need to do there. So we already work with law enforcement a lot. We just need to understand what that barrier is. But most of the time, when we're talking about these acute investigations, we're talking about the acute incident, as long as you're sticking with the details that are directly needed, that they need, that's fine. Just, again, don't be silly. Don't go into a bunch of details that don't actually relate to what's going on, and you should be safe.
Right. And something you mentioned about the overstepping bounds and cooperation, something that I always, always, always try to talk to my investigators about, is especially, and we're in a rural area, even in big city, but there's more rural area hospitals than there are big city trauma centers, all right? So in a rural area, patrol officer, detective, coroner, medical examiner, investigator, stop by the ER and have a cup of coffee. Stop by the ER and get to know the doctors and the PAs and the nurses. Get to know them, because it's a rural area. And when Detective Jones shows up at the ER at 2 o'clock in the morning to refill his coffee cup up and says hi to everybody, you know, once that relationship develops over time, when there is a case come in, it's not that I'm saying that we want to tell our friends information we shouldn't say. That's not what I'm getting at. But when there's a relationship developed and you've talked to them about, what do you guys say HIPAA involves? What do I need? What do you need? You know, you have these conversations over the months and the years. When something comes up, then it's no longer, who is this detective and who is this nurse? We all know each other, and now we know what our boundaries are, and it makes it a lot easier to work together. I've always said, when you build relationships first, everything else can come second, but it's a relationship that's in the beginning. Now, one of the things that we also have talked about this, the information at the ER level, there really is, I'm very generically here, I guess, for some other hospitals, but in my area, if I have a death present to the ER, or ED as it's now called, I can usually walk out of there with all the notes right then. They may be handwritten, they may be scratched out, they may not be totally computerized and perfect, but generally I say that I need all the care notes from the time this person came in, and they'll copy them. I have no problem walking out with them. Again, we've built relationships. Does not violate HIPAA. Perfectly okay to do that. But there's some hospitals that won't give it immediately. But I think immediate is important. If an investigator is there trying to work this and they're taking this body, sent into autopsy, that forensic pathologist wants to know what the ER did. If I've got to wait 4 or 5 days for that to be transcribed and typed and go through records, I need it now. Is that your is that what you're used to doing, or have you heard of other hospitals having problems with that?
So Before we get into that, because Darren, you did such a great job with this, I think it's almost worth reemphasizing because you just said it so quickly, is it's all about the relationships, like yes. you said. And this is something that we try and do this anyway, but I really encourage that anyone who's listening to this, just talk to whether it's you are the paramedic or you're the nurse or you are the law enforcement officer, whoever you are, just make sure that every time we run into each other, we're just having a nice little conversation, because it is much better to have that conversation ahead of time. Like you said, the months to years ahead of time where you develop a protocol, or maybe we don't have a great answer or we don't know the policy in place, rather than looking at it 2 a.m. when everyone's already flustered because of what's happened. And now we need to get people involved that we normally wouldn't get involved. Well, now we can deal with this in a calm manner because we've worked this out before. Or maybe we just, you know, again, maybe we haven't even specifically talked about this scenario, but we have a better relationship. And we do. I encourage the same thing when we're talking interprofessionally. So when I'm talking to the ENT physician or to the orthopedic surgeon or whoever, that we already have a relationship in place. So that way we're collegial, and that's the whole goal. Yeah. So dealing with the notes specifically, this one's a little more complex, because most of the time, yeah, we're not going to have an issue with it, or at least maybe I may not be able to give you the note right then, but I can at least give you the details I think are going to be what you need from us. And because sometimes, like you said, depending on your facility, this may be something that takes a little bit of time. But I would also encourage for the hospitals, maybe you're reluctant or maybe you don't know what your policy is, check your policy. Most likely you have a policy somewhere in place at your hospital that says it's totally fine to do this. And if you're not certain, talk to an administrator. What we want to try and avoid is you talking to an administrator at 2 a.m. because the administrator is not going to be awake and is not going to understand very well. And I've seen this happen multiple times before where we talk to an administrator about something and they don't really know the answer. Not at 2 a.m. Maybe if you ask them 2 p.m, they'll maybe be a little more awake. Maybe they'll be a little tired from lunch or something, but they'll be a little more awake than they are at 2 a.m. And the reason why I mention all this is because this will help streamline everything. People are happier. People feel like they're getting the right answers. And we're trying to avoid any delays in law enforcement or our day, because a lot of times this ties us up for a while too, because we're trying to do all the stuff we need to do. We want to make sure the notes are there available quickly as possible. And we want to make sure we get back to the rest of our shift, because we have other patients usually that we're seeing at the time. It's not just that one critically ill patient. We probably have 20 other patients in the ED. A lot of times that happens to us. But we really want to avoid where we have to cause delays because we're either talking to law enforcement or we're talking to our administrator, or we're even talking to the hospital's attorney. That's never really fun, because a lot of times they're not going to know the answer at 2 a.m. either. They're going to wish they could look something up. So work ahead of time. Either learn your policy, which all the different places I looked at after a recent event, I went and looked up our policies at our different facilities, and they all exist. And I imagine that almost every hospital probably has something there. And if not, there's at least laws at the Supreme Court level and stuff like that, where decisions have been made previously that support where you can share this information.
Yeah, I think I agree with you that every hospital has a policy in place. Ever since HIPAA came around, then there was a bunch of headbutting go on because, well, I can't give you this. That's all been worked out. And what a coroner or medical examiner can get is different than what a police can get because of subpoena issues. That's all been worked out. But if you're an ER person and you don't know what your policy is or what the law is, because maybe you're new to it or maybe you don't see very many deaths, then find out. Because when that coroner walks in and this person has died, they're going to want ER notes right now. Mm-hmm. Then you need to know, here's our policy. I can't, or I can, or what can I give? And generally, the ER notes are just important because it lets us know what they presented with, what you did, and then ultimately that they died. That's important for us to know if we're trying to determine cause and manner. Now, again, a car accident may not go to an autopsy, but we want to know, and we don't want to have to. There's reasons why we don't want to wait several days, but. You know, what did they present with? Did you do a CT? What did the CT show? Did they have internal bleeding? Were you working with that? What were you doing as part of the ER? What did the paramedics say? What did you do? Because that helps us with our cause, manner, and mechanism. They may have died from blunt force trauma, but maybe not. Maybe it was something else that actually caused their death. So the ER notes are important for us quickly. So, but that's something that each hospital needs to determine. And again, big city hospitals, I've got notes from them as well, but it takes a lot longer because they have a bureaucracy that is amazingly thick. But again, I'm sure the local people probably have a better relationship. But if we have somebody flown to a big hospital, me getting information from them, it takes a little bit more time. But again, most places, of course, are rural. We're getting close on our time here, Chip, and I want to give just a few minutes for you to give any last comments. But also, I want you to talk a little bit more about your podcast and where some of my listeners, especially the ones that are in the EMS field or in the medical field, because we do have paramedics, and I do know we have some ER staff listening to this show. Again, let's talk about your show. Who do you concentrate on? Who's your primary listener? And then where can you be found? Website, things like that.
So Total EM can be found at totalem.org, and we focus on pretty much anyone who practices in emergency medicine, whether you're a registered nurse, a paramedic, EMT, physician, PA, NP. It doesn't matter. As long as you're in emergency medicine, you're going to find something helpful. In fact, sometimes some of our stuff is not even related to emergency medicine. It may just be primary care in general. But I'm sure if you take the time to look at it, and again, like you said, even if you're law enforcement or you're a death investigator, however you fit in the spectrum, it's worth checking out the site because there's going to be some interesting topics that come on there. Like you said, the HIMSS issue where we have helicopter ambulances that are not as safe as they should be. That's a big one. That was a really popular one because it hit a lot of people. Because anyone who's essentially some form of a first responder, this hits them one way or another. We want our flight crews to be safe. And so fortunately, there are things that are happening as a result of that. But then there are other things that I feel like pretty much most of the listeners will find helpful too. We talk about opiate overdoses, and we talk about the proper PPE that you use in an opiate case. It's actually really interesting because unfortunately, this is somewhere where I in some ways disagree with what has come out with a lot of law enforcement stuff where they basically make it sound like if you touch fentanyl, you're going to die. That's, I wouldn't say far from the truth, but that's not entirely accurate. There's some serious issues with education that happened because of early axioms that were taught that basically these people were dying when realistically there were other things that were playing a role in there. And so naloxone or Narcan has been used excessively by some departments in some locations because they think that's what they're supposed to do. And realistically, probably didn't need to do that in the first place. And we've seen that in emergency departments as well and in EMS and stuff like that. The reason why I mentioned that one specifically is because it's very much worth looking through. It's very quick. It'll be easy enough for you to listen to. You can also read specifically the show notes on all of our podcasts as well, going through the details. But one of my favorite things about that one is that it's been reviewed by toxicologists, and we made sure to get toxicologists involved because they can explain a lot more detail about how this actually works. Like with fentanyl overdose and stuff, you just touching fentanyl powder is very low risk. It's more prolonged exposure, stuff like that. So I just mentioned that one specifically. But of course, there's other things out there too that are very helpful. And like I said, it's worth just checking out because I'm sure everyone, you can find something on there that's worthwhile. Like I said, the opiate one's kind of interesting too. And I also talk about how to use other things besides opiates. Again, like what we talked about, maybe in a high acuity case, or maybe just because we're trying to avoid contributing anymore to the opiate epidemic that we're dealing with right now. So like I said, we've got all sorts of stuff on there, totalem.org. And you can also find podcasts basically on most podcast players, but I would recommend going to iTunes if you have it. The Apple Podcast, I think, is now what they call it. But check it out. All you have to do is type in totalem and you'll be able to find it. And totalem is technically two separate words. So, but on the website, of course, it's just totalem.org, all one word.
Right. And I listened to your show since I found it. I actually, it was recommended to me by somebody, and I listen to your show every week, and I learned something. Now, again, as I said, there are some things that talk a little over my head. You guys are talking about something or another, and you're using your jargon, which I can follow along, but some stuff I don't actually understand. But what it does help me to do is understand the job that you do and why you do certain things, right? Now, not just the opioid thing, but what was the last show was on?
Probably lung ultrasound,
yes,
is that one?
Lung ultrasounds with pneumothorax. Something.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, you get in the weeds there. I mean, you get pretty technical on some of that stuff, right? So I can follow the path, But obviously, you guys are talking about things that I don't do every day. But it helps me and to understand, and I think my listeners to understand, oh, this is what they're talking about, and this is what they do.
And that's actually something I think would be helpful for this discussion, since you brought it up real quick, because I was debating whether to mention that. Point-of-care ultrasound, or POCUS, is becoming a growing part of medicine, especially emergency medicine. And in certain locations, like some of the places I work, we can't always save our images. So this is different from what a death investigator may have when they have access to a chest x-ray that can show the pneumothorax on there. I may have that for you on ultrasound on a clip, but it's not going to look the same way as you've seen before, or I may not have the image at all. I may just have to document that in the report, whether I could not save the images in a quick enough time or whatever happened. Something happened there that we don't always have that to give to you. So it's worth understanding that bedside ultrasound or point of care ultrasound, POCUS, is going to be something where you really need to understand that we are using this more and more. It's very beneficial for us, but it sometimes may give you a little less information where you can actually look at something later. But usually we're making good enough details and notes so you can understand what we're seeing and why we're doing things the way we are. And for example, the pneumothorax thing, like you said, it's a very detailed podcast. It's one of the more detailed podcasts on pneumothoraces out there. But it's something that it's worth kind of almost just paying attention to, just to understand that we're doing this and we're looking for certain things, and this is why we document the way we do.
Right, which is exactly why I love the podcast, and I'm glad I found it. And, you know, and for your listeners, you know, the Coroner Talk podcast is at coronertalk.com, but it's the same thing that we do, is that we just talk about death investigation. Regardless of what the death investigation is, what we're dealing with, but where you guys can help us understand the medical field, we can help you guys understand death investigation and how we do our job, which, like we talked about today with the evidence and things. But as an overall, and there's be some topics that you may, your listeners might not be interested in hearing, but most of them will benefit them in some way because it tells them what the coroner and medical examiner is doing out there before they come into the ED, how this case is going to progress after it leaves the ED. And, you know, just because you call your local OPO and that person may leave your hospital, go on to organ procurement, the medical examiner is involved after that. What do they do? What have you done to change what they do, and vice versa? So that's why I listen to Fire Podcasts. That's why I listen to some paramedic podcasts, because again, we're all in that. We absolutely are on the same team. We are dealing with patient care. Sometimes we're dealing with patient care at the scene, and sometimes we're dealing with patient care at the morgue, but we still have the patient as a whole care, and we all have to work together to get the right answers. That's how I always say it.
And to tie into that, I feel like, just like you said, Darren, is that yes, Total EM can help your listeners, just like your podcast can help my listeners, where you can listen to that and really get a better understanding, because we're only talking about a couple of small facets for a very specific issue. But if you want more of this information, check out Darren's stuff, because it's great. And he's been doing this for 4 years. There's a lot of information that you can get and glean from it and be able to apply to your practice. Maybe it's just as simple as understanding what happens later, so that maybe you can help better prepare that patient or better prepare your documentation to help support what's going on and give them the information they need. So hopefully, maybe this will be a little incentive for some of my guys. So hopefully later, you may not necessarily have to go to court, or maybe you won't have to go to court as long to try and answer some of these details that they're going to ask you about later.
Right, because we all know we don't like court and we have opinions about attorneys. We won't talk about attorneys.
We won't talk about attorneys today. Too many attorney jokes.
Too many attorney jokes. And I love attorneys. Yeah, okay. I do like attorneys, most of them. Okay, so anyway, Chip, thank you for coming by the studios today and taking some time to pour into us and talk to the coroners and death investigators around the country. I appreciate you taking the time to do that. And I appreciate the job that you do as emergency medicine, because, again, you are on the front lines to save lives. And your podcast is wonderful. I hope everybody takes the time to check it out, at least download two or three. I always say about our show, you may not like this show, but give us three shows and you'll find a fit somewhere within our podcast. Chip, again, thank you very much for being on the show. Have a wonderful, wonderful day.
Thank you. All right, so I'm just going to wrap this up here real quick with a couple of last notes. Again, Coroner Talk is where we're at. They're also an Apple podcast, just like we are. And you can also
Go to their website. We'll include that in the show notes. Please check them out. Please, if you're interested in this at all, which a lot of medical professionals are, as Darren's told me in the past, this is something that I think is worth at least just checking out. Listen to a few. There's some good stuff on just kind of different things that does apply directly to medicine. And then also, you know, let people know about that podcast, just like you let people know about this podcast. But until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.